This is Ned Ryan, and welcome to the History of the Constitutional Convention, Episode 8. In the last podcast, I talked about the delegates who came to the convention. Remember that there were 12 states in attendance, with Rhode Island and Providence plantations refusing to send delegates, and there were 55 delegates who came to Philadelphia. In today's podcast, I'll pick up with the New York delegation. The New York delegation was led by Alexander Hamilton, though the other two delegates had been sent by New York's governor to offset Hamilton's strong national government sentiments. Hamilton was only 30 at the time of the convention, but was already a national figure. Along with Madison and Washington, Hamilton was one of the strongest advocates for a convention to revise the Articles of Confederation. However, in something of an irony considering his work on getting an actual convention, Hamilton played a very minor role at the convention. His one speech of note was about 6 hours long and was rejected by every delegate as extreme in nature. Hamilton would later be accused of advocating for an American king. He left the convention a few days after his speech, but later returned to sit on the Committee of Style, which drafted the final copy of the document, and he, of course, voted for and signed the Constitution. He became the driving force behind the Federalist Papers, written to advocate and defend the new Constitution in the state of New York. And Hamilton would later become the first Secretary of Treasury under Washington, but in 1804 was killed in his infamous duel with Aaron Burr. John Lansing, the mayor of Albany, was a strong opponent of a centralized government advocated by Hamilton. After 6 weeks, he left the convention along with Robert Yates, explaining to the governor of New York that the convention was overstepping its bounds and writing a new constitution. Lansing would be a strong opponent of the Constitution during the New York ratification debates. He would enjoy a long judicial career, eventually becoming the Chief Justice of the New York Supreme Court. However, in 1829, while visiting New York City, Lansing mysteriously disappeared and was never found, and was presumed murdered. Robert Yates was a recognized leader of the Anti-Federalists, and was afraid a strong central government would take away states' rights. Yates left the convention early with Lansing, and then wrote a series of letters attacking the Constitution. He would help lead the effort to defeat the ratification of the Constitution in New York. He eventually became the Chief Justice of the New York Supreme Court for 8 years, succeeded at that post by John Lansing. The New Hampshire delegation was late to the convention, arriving July 21st, after most of the major debates had already occurred. Nicholas Gilman played a minor role in the proceedings, though he later would become a U.S. representative and a senator. John Langdon, however, spoke frequently at the time that he was present at the convention and played a significant role in the slavery compromise. A man of wealth, Langdon later became a U.S. senator and the governor of New Hampshire. He was also a charter member of the American Bible Society. The state of Maryland sent Dr. James McHenry. A native of Ireland, McHenry studied medicine under Dr. Benjamin Rush, who was a signer of the Declaration of Independence. And then later McHenry served in the Continental Army, becoming George Washington's secretary. After the war, McHenry served in the Maryland Senate, and he also served in the Continental Congress. Though he missed most of the convention due to a brother's illness, McHenry would sign the Constitution and later became the Secretary of War under George Washington and John Adams. During his semi-retirement from public life, McHenry helped found the Baltimore Bible Society, serving as its president for a period of time. Daniel Carroll came from a wealthy Catholic family in Maryland, remaining out of the public eye until the early 1780s. Though he was late to the convention, he became a strong advocate for the Constitution and later signed the document. He would become a U.S. representative and in 1791 was assigned by Washington to survey and define the District of Columbia, of which Carroll owned a great deal of land. Daniel of St. Thomas Jennifer was one of the wealthier delegates at the convention. Though he did represent Maryland at the 1785 convention at Mount Vernon, and was one of only 29 delegates to attend every session of the Constitutional Convention, Jennifer rarely spoke at the convention. A supporter of Madison's ideas for a strong national government, Jennifer would sign the Constitution. He never again held a public office, and passed away 3 years later, after the Philadelphia Convention. Luther Martin was the Attorney General of Maryland, and has been called by some the wild man of the convention for his vehement speeches against the ideas of a strong centralized government. A small statesman through and through, Martin helped craft the New Jersey Plan and was an advocate of the Connecticut Compromise. He would oppose slaves being counted for representation purposes as the state's attorney general. In 1807, he served as defense for Aaron Burr in Burr's treason trial, and then continued to serve as Maryland's attorney general for 28 years. John Francis Mercer, only 28 years old at the time of the convention, was strongly opposed to the idea of centralizing power. Along with Martin, he left the convention early, refusing to sign the Constitution. He later served in the U.S. House and then served two terms as Maryland's governor. The state of Georgia sent Abraham Baldwin, a native of Connecticut who had just moved to Georgia in 1785. Though his role at the convention was inconspicuous, Baldwin would go on to serve 18 years in the U.S. House and Senate, eventually dying while in office. And he's actually buried in Washington, D.C., in the Rock Creek area. A veteran of the Revolutionary War, William Few would be absent for large portions of the convention, though he provided key votes for the Federalist faction. As a member of the Continental Congress, Few helped Congress approve the Constitution and later served as one of Georgia's first U.S. senators. William Houston, schooled in London, was a member of a family who were high-ranking officials under the crown. But with the Revolutionary War, Houston broke with most of his family and advocated the use of armed resistance against Great Britain. He would only be present at the convention for several weeks during the month of July. William Pierce played an insubstantial role at the convention, though he was an advocate of strengthening the national government. He left the convention early to look after his business, and several years after the convention, at the age of 49, he passed away. However, his notes on the convention and his thoughts and descriptions of the delegates have proven invaluable to succeeding generations. The state of Massachusetts since sent as one of its delegates Elbridge Gerry, a tiny man who was a longtime member of the Continental Congress and a signer of the Declaration of Independence. A rather dour man, Gerry did little to gain friends, but was well respected for his talents. He proved to be one of the more vocal delegates of the convention, and presided as the chairman of the committee that formally offered the Great Compromise. Inconsistent in his stances, Gerry began the convention as a strong advocate of centralized government, only to eventually vote against the Constitution and work against its ratification in Massachusetts. Then, elected to the first Congress, Gerry ended up advocating Federalist views, much to the chagrin of the Anti-Federalists. Gerry ran for governor of Massachusetts and was defeated four times before eventually winning two terms. Perhaps the most ironic aspect of Gerry's career is that his name is still used quite frequently in politics today. While governor, the Democrat Republicans, with his approval, redistricted the state Senate seats in Massachusetts to ensure their continued domination of that chamber. In response, the Federalists heaped scorn and abuse on Gerry, coining the term gerrymander to describe one of the new districts shaped like a salamander. Gerry was joined by Nathaniel Gorham, former president of the Continental Congress. A wealthy businessman, Gorham played a significant role at the convention, attending every session. Unlike most of his fellow delegates, Gorham would not hold a position in the new government. He became embroiled in a disastrous land speculation effort, and when his investments were lost, Gorham fell into bankruptcy and out of grace in both the political and social circles in Massachusetts. At the age of 32, Rufus King was one of the youngest delegates at the convention. However, his skills as an orator made him a forceful figure during the convention. Initially, King believed all that was needed was a revising of the articles. However, by the end of the convention, he, along with Madison, had become one of the strongest voices advocating for a new national government. King would move to New York the year after the convention and was actually elected as one of New York's first U.S. senators. He later served as the minister to Great Britain, and in 1804 and 1808 was the Federalist candidate for vice president. In 1816, he was the Federalist candidate for president, but was beaten decisively by James Monroe. King continued on as a U.S. senator and would later once more serve as minister to Great Britain, before passing away at the age of 72. Caleb Strong came to the convention as a strong advocate for a new government. He had served as a defense attorney for the rebels during Shays' Rebellion, and during the Great Compromise debates, it would be Strong who proposed that all money bills originate in the House of Representatives. Called home due to a family illness, Strong would not be able to sign the Constitution. In 1800, he won the governorship of Massachusetts, defeating Elbridge Gerry 4 times, en route to serving 6 one-year terms as governor. He later defeated Gerry again in 1812 for the governorship and served another 4 years in that role for a total of 10 annual terms as governor of the state of Massachusetts. New Jersey's delegation included David Brearley, the acting Chief Justice of the New Jersey Supreme Court. He was a strong supporter of William Paterson's New Jersey plan and favored equal representation for every state in the new federal legislature. Brearley would later be appointed as a federal judge by Washington, but only served in that post for 3 years before passing away. The youngest delegate to the convention at the age of 26 was Jonathan Dayton, a veteran of the Revolutionary War and a participant at the Battle of Yorktown. He disagreed strongly with the Virginia plan, but eventually signed the Constitution. Later elected to the U.S. House of Representatives, Dayton served as the Speaker of the House for the 4th and 5th sessions of Congress. William Houston, another veteran of the Revolutionary War, had also served in the Continental Congress. However, Houston only attended the convention for 1 week before being forced home by illness, and he died in 1788 of tuberculosis. William Livingston, who was the acting governor of New Jersey at the time of the convention, was sporadic in his attendance of the convention due to his duties as governor. A supporter of the New Jersey plan, Livingston eventually signed the Constitution and helped ensure the ratification of that document in New Jersey. The most prominent delegate of the New Jersey delegation at the convention was William Paterson. A successful lawyer who was just 5 feet tall, Paterson spearheaded the effort in rebutting the Virginia plan, offering his own plan, termed the New Jersey plan, which asserted the rights of the small states against the large. He left the convention early, only to return in time to sign the Constitution. Paterson later served as a U.S. Senator, governor of New Jersey, and finally as an associate justice on the U.S. Supreme Court. William Blount was a member of the State House and Senate in North Carolina and was a member of the Continental Congress before being elected as a delegate to the Constitutional Convention by the state of North Carolina. Blount spent most of the remainder of his life in public office. He said very little during the convention and reluctantly signed the Constitution, though later he became a strong advocate of the Constitution during North Carolina's ratification debates. Blount failed in his desire to be elected as one of North Carolina's first senators and struck out for the West, eventually building a mansion in Knoxville, Tennessee in 1792. He presided over the state convention that transformed Tennessee from a territory into a state, and was elected one of Tennessee's first U.S. senators. However, Blount's plans to conquer for Britain the Spanish provinces of Florida and Louisiana fell into the hands of President John Adams in July of 1797. Blount was impeached by the House, and though not convicted by the Senate, he was expelled from the body. Born in England, William Davy immigrated to America in 1763. During the Revolutionary War, Davy raised an American troop of cavalry and rose to the rank of colonel in the Continental Army. A respected lawyer and member of the North Carolina legislature, Davy favored a strong central government at the convention. Though he did not sign the document, Davy was a strong advocate for its ratification. He went on to become the chief founder of the University of North Carolina and was later the governor of North Carolina. Alexander Martin was a former deputy justice of King George III. However, when the War of Independence broke out, he became a lieutenant colonel in the South Carolina militia. He rose to the rank of colonel in the Continental Army, but after the Battle of Germantown in 1777, he was court-martialed on charges of cowardice. Though the charges were dismissed, Martin resigned his commission that year. He went into politics and became a state senator and president of that chamber. He served as governor of the state from 1781 until 1785. As a delegate to the convention, Martin would not take much of an active role in the debates, though he did favor a strong national government. After the convention, Martin once again served as the governor of North Carolina and later as a U.S. senator. At the age of 29, Richard Dobbs Spaight was one of the youngest delegates to the convention. Elected as Speaker of the North Carolina House at the age of 27, Spaight was one of the brighter political figures in the entire state of North Carolina. Though he attended every session at the convention, Spaight would have a very limited role in the actual debates. He returned home to North Carolina after signing the Constitution and later entered the U.S. House of Representatives. Only 44 years old, in 1802, Speight was killed in a duel with a political rival. Hugh Williamson studied medicine until beginning his political career in 1782. He served in the State House of North Carolina and also in the Continental Congress before the convention, where he proved himself a very skilled orator and debater. Unlike the other members of the North Carolina delegation, Williamson played a significant role at the convention and played a prominent role in the compromise over representation. He represented North Carolina for 2 terms in the U.S. House, then moved to New York City to continue his literary and philanthropic pursuits. South Carolina's contingent at the convention was, in the words of one historian, an ingrown affair. Charles Cotesworth and Charles Pinckney were first cousins. The sister of General Pinckney's wife was married to John Rutledge's brother, and Major Butler's wife was a cousin to the two sisters who had wed General Pinckney and the Rutledge brother. To avoid further confusion, let's just say that the South Carolina delegation knew each other quite well. Pierce Butler was born in Ireland, and he's one of the more interesting characters at the convention. He was the younger son of a baronet who was a member of the Parliament. Joining the British Army, Butler would actually be sent to Boston in 1768 to help put down the unrest in that city. However, he married the daughter of a South Carolina planter several years later and moved to Charleston, resigned his commission, and when the Revolution broke out, he quickly joined the American side and became a general in the South Carolina militia. A strong voice for the Madison contingent at the convention, Butler also argued for the rights of the Southern slaveholder. He later served as one of South Carolina's first U.S. senators, and after his public service, lived out his life as a wealthy planter. Charles Pinckney was one of the youngest delegates at the convention, and had previously served in the Continental Congress and in the South Carolina legislature, and like his older cousin, had led American troops during the Revolutionary War. Though, like his older cousin, Charles would end the war in a British prison camp. Though Pinckney's claims of being the most influential delegate to the convention, due to his submitting a draft that the Constitution was based on, is rejected by most historians, he was nonetheless a prominent figure at the convention. He was nicknamed Blackguard Charlie, probably by John Adams for all we know, and he intentionally misstated his age after the convention so that he could appear to have been the youngest delegate at the Constitutional Convention. The only problem was that it was a lie. At 29, Charles was 3 years older than Jonathan Dayton of New Jersey, and to add insult to injury, Charles' lie about his age was made public. But Charles did appear in Philadelphia with a draft constitution in hand, something that not even James Madison had done. Charles attended every meeting, speaking frequently and effectively for the cause of a new centralized government. After the convention, Pinckney served as South Carolina's governor, a U.S. senator, minister to Spain, and later in the U.S. House. Charles Cotesworth Pinckney, first cousins with Charles Pinckney, was a brevet major general during the Revolution, and like Charles, had ended the Revolutionary War in a British prison camp. He was a successful lawyer, having read law in England before the war. A member of both chambers of the South Carolina legislature, Pinckney came to Philadelphia as a strong advocate of the new national government. He played a prominent role in the slave debates, and eventually signed the Constitution. He later served as the U.S. minister to France, and was John Adams' vice presidential candidate in 1800. He would run for president himself against Thomas Jefferson in 1804, and then in 1808 against James Madison. In 1816, Pinckney was one of the original charter members of the American Bible Society. John Rutledge was the leader of the South Carolina delegation. Called the most successful lawyer in America at the time, Rutledge was the older brother of Edward Rutledge, who was a signer of the Declaration of Independence, and was a member of both the First and Second Continental Congresses. He'd been nicknamed the Dictator while governor of South Carolina, and was known to be overbearing and rude. John Adams described Rutledge as having an air of reserve, design, and cunning, leaving one to wonder what Adams actually thought of Rutledge. Though South Carolina's contingent was small, and South Carolina as a state was insignificant population-wise, Rutledge and the others from South Carolina would play a significant role at the convention. Now, I know in one of the last podcasts, I pointed out that John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, and others were not at the convention as they were serving abroad. But men like Patrick Henry, Richard Henry Lee, Sam Adams, and George Clinton, governor of New York, all strong anti-nationalists and leaders of the anti-nationalist forces in America stayed away from the convention. I can't help but think that this was an extreme tactical error, especially by Henry and Lee, who were both elected as delegates to the convention and powerful leaders in their own right. What if they had come to Philadelphia? History might very well have been different. Now, at least you have a rough idea of who the men were in Philadelphia debating and framing the Constitution. In next week's podcast, the convention will begin, and as you'll see, the fireworks and contentious debates started within days of the convention beginning.